This is Dr. Joel B. Gooden. Today I'll be interviewing Dr. Eric Donald. He's a great guy. He's a student that just finished recently, and he has a lot to share about his dissertation on Black father interaction and involvement in their children's lives. There's also a lot of practical implications from his research and things that he and I are thinking about doing together to influence both Black fathers and fathers of all kinds. And in doing so, hopefully, make the world better for all children, females, all genders. So, take a listen. I hope you enjoy. Listeners, this is Joel. I'm Dr. Gooden, but you can call me Joel. Listen, I'm trying to put good content out there, and it takes time to do it. And I'm not real good at putting everything together yet. I'm getting better. I'm trying to come up with new ideas. I want to listen to you and hear what you want. In order to make all this happen, I would love to have a little bit of investment. If you like what you're hearing, it would help me to spend more time to do this. If you could give any donation to my Stripe account, just supporting the podcast. Thank you so much for considering this. Even a dollar would help. If you've got a dollar that you can spare just to say, hey, you're headed in the right direction, I got something out of this, that would be great. Don't forget to like, subscribe, share, comment, give 7 thumbs up, stars, whatever they are. But overall, thank you for listening, and thank you for any support you can provide. Even a dollar would help. Thank you. Hello, this is Dr. Joel B. Gooden with Driven to Doctorate. Today I have a student of mine that is no longer a student. May I introduce Dr. Eric Donald. How are you, Eric?
Well, Dr. Gooden. How are you?
Excellent. Call me Joel. You're supposed to call me Joel now.
Okay. That may take some getting.
It takes a while.
Okay.
It takes a while. I still call up my chair, call her doctor. But you're good, man. Yeah, and you just finished, how long ago was it? June? June, and we're in August?
Yeah. June 23rd, to be exact. So
June 23rd, I was just looking at your defense. As I told you, I was trying to find a good picture of you for the interview, the end scenes, you know, like where I'm gonna put your, maybe a LinkedIn or something like that. So we'll come back to that.
Okay.
But I want everybody just to meet you. But I also like to sort of share the story of dissertation that each person experiences. And I do have a lot of other chairs that I'll talk to, but I also like to grab the students as they're finished and they're sort of figuring out what to do next. But that you've got the most, like, this recent insight, you know, it's been pretty recent, right, that you finished, and now you're sort of processing all of it, you're figuring out what to do next, and we just had a conversation about that before the interview started, a little bit, talking about what to do, and it looks like you've got some great ideas. But I always like to, in my interviews, I like to go back to sort of how you got started. So let's go back to your roots. You mind sharing where you came from and you know, how you grew up?
Absolutely. So I'm originally from Saginaw, Michigan, which is, it's a blue collar town about 90 miles northwest of Detroit. Wasn't too big of a town, not too small of a town either. It was about 100,000 people there, I believe, during the time when I was growing up there. My parents, they were, they worked in the automotive industry, like a lot of folks in that area did during those times. They also owned their own bait and tackle shop. So that was kind of where I think for my brothers and myself, that's where we learned how important it was to work. Because for us, summer vacations really weren't summer vacations because we were required Monday through Saturday to be up and at it by 4 a.m. And it was unfortunate for us that we lived right next door to our parents' business. So it was like a 15 minutes to get up, wash our faces and get started for the day. So from 4 a.m. to about 6 p.m., that's what we did every day during the summer months. And ironically, my parents sold their place of business the year after I graduated from high school. And I was the last one of the bunch. So, and we always kind of like laugh about that because it was like, they knew once all of the help was out of the house, they decided to like just close the doors and just shut down. But it was a great experience. But from that, I think how I kind of landed where I'm at in terms of ever thinking about going on this doctoral journey, in a nutshell, it was being able to look at how my dad was able to interact with other people. And you know, people would come in just to buy bait, to go fishing, and that would turn into sometimes a 3-4-5 hour conversation because his customers used those moments as a form of therapy. It was someone that could listen to them. It was someone that they, I would like to believe that they held with a high level of respect. He was ex-military and and he had been around the world. So he knew some things and he didn't mind sharing those thoughts with people. And I think that's kind of, that was the first beginning of me wanting to not only pursue my education, but as I got further into my education, thinking about, okay, how can I use this to help other people? And that's essentially how I, ended up in the psychology program here at North Central.
Right, right. Yeah, so where'd you do undergrad and master's?
Sorry about that. So during my time in Nebraska, I lived in Omaha, Nebraska for about 6.5 years. So I did my undergrad and my master's at Bellevue University. And Bellevue was actually a suburb of Omaha. So I received my bachelor's of science in healthcare administration and my master's of arts in human services.
All right. All right. And then you ended up at North Central, where we met. And I think tell us, you were already doing this. I don't know, how long have you been doing what you do now, and share what you do. You work with fathers, correct?
Yes. So that's a part of my responsibilities. I do have like a dual role. So starting in 2012, I at the organization that I currently am employed at, I started out as an infant mental health therapist / fatherhood coordinator. So the infant mental health portion, that required me to work with families of children between the ages of 0 and 3. And as of January of this year, my roles kind of switched. So now I'm a supports coordinator, which is basically like the admin piece of all the different programming throughout the organization. So whether it's like infant mental health, if it's fatherhood related, if it's 7 to 17, if it's wraparound, all of those different programs, I'm essentially like the case holder for certain families. But the fatherhood work that I'm involved in, that actually started 2 years prior to me coming to this organization. I did fatherhood work at the previous organization where I was at. So,
okay, cool. And it makes me wonder, and I think it's part of the story that we're sort of telling today. I see these interviews always as sort of telling someone's story, but it also should hopefully give information to people along the way as well. But in telling your story, you know, I've heard you mention your dad in the bait and tackle shop, and how he seemed to listen to people, talk to people. He was, sounds like maybe a likable person. And then what was it that sort of, in your mind, led you to start working with fathers? What led you to that? Was it luck or was it a plan?
It was actually by chance. I was given an option. I was given the option to either work with fathers. Again, going back to the organization that I was working for previously, and they were starting this program up. It was just really like fatherhood outreach work. It wasn't too intensive. It was just pretty much about making cold calls and trying to make sure that the fathers felt included in the process. That was it. It was just really basic. And I enjoyed it because a lot of those calls that I would make just to introduce myself, also just to extend to the fathers a warm welcome, to the organization or whatever the case may have been, it led to like more in-depth conversations. And it was just like, wow, this would be really neat to be able to have a program that was tailored toward fathers. So then the opportunity came that I saw at the organization that I'm currently working for, where they were just starting a program of that magnitude, where it was going to be geared toward trying to involve fathers in the process. And that's how, I kind of landed in that particular spot. But I want to just add real quick, I had the autonomy the entire time to kind of make that program whatever I wanted to make it, because there wasn't a blueprint that had been established to say, hey, we need to do A, B, and C. It was just like, come in, as long as you're interacting with dads, whatever that may look like, just go ahead and implement it and go from there. So a part of that, that process for me was trying to create a curriculum that the fathers that were part of that program could follow in our parents and our groups.
Cool. That sounds great. And you and I have talked about how important fatherhood is, and just sort of it's special. There's a lot of sort of discussion about fatherhood these days. In your dissertation, you focused specifically on Black fathers and the degree to which they attached and interacted with their children. And I think before we get into that, I told you I was looking online last night. I just want to read this off. This is based on the most recent Census Bureau 2020. Life arrangements of children under 18 years old, 1960 to present. All right, so, but this is as of 2020. So, children without a father in the home are at 4 times greater risk of poverty, 7 times more likely to become pregnant as a teen, more likely to have behavioral problems, more likely to face abuse and neglect, 2 times greater risk of infant mortality in those homes, more likely to abuse drugs and alcohol, more likely to go to prison, 2 times more likely to suffer obesity, more likely to commit crime, 2 times more likely to drop out of high school. And all these things are big issues. And I only sort of hit the big ones. There's so much to unpack there. But the point is that it's not a non-issue. Are there children that succeed and do really well in life without a father? Yes, absolutely, right? But we're talking about the statistics, the likelihood, the odds ratios of what is more likely. What risks are you at if you don't have a father in the home? What obstacles does that put in your path? What does that make you more vulnerable to? And that's sort of what your dissertation dealt with to some extent. So I want to ask you, you know, tell about your dissertation, Eric.
So my dissertation primarily discussed many of the areas that you just read off in terms of what are the effects of absenteeism, low father involvement, and even father involvement that may not necessarily be so low. It discussed elements such as systemic racism, discussed how when we think about systemic racism, when we talk about, you know, we go into like law enforcement, those are like some of the areas I think that, you know, may come to mind for a lot of people. And rightfully so, I think in some instances, but my dissertation, I think went a little deeper. It also discussed how something as simple as just like our dietary habits could cause problems. And that it all stems from like even during slavery and not being able to eat certain foods, but then that becoming tradition, some of those foods being, you know, becoming tradition in the Black community, and people now, even in 2021, you know, may still eat, you know, some of those types of food and not really realizing why they do it other than it just being tradition. So that can cause problems like, you know, diabetes, hypertension, things of that nature. Also, just thinking about how social economics play a role. If, you know, a person doesn't have an opportunity to have access to like better education or education, being in an education system growing up, that person probably run the risk of having to work more menial jobs, and you know how people become desperate when they don't have financial, you know, means. So that way, if they become involved in criminal activities, and then like criminal activities can lead to, unfortunately, and this doesn't necessarily have to do with just with race, but just this is kind of where the social economics come back into play. There's two justice systems in this country. So like there's a justice system for the affluent, and there's a justice system for those who may not necessarily have a financial means. So unfortunately, a lot of you know, Black fathers have kind of fell into that category of not being affluent. And so they may be overcharged for crimes that people with financial means may only get off of like probation or something along those lines. So I think that, you know, discussing like all of those different areas and trying to discover like what are some of the root causes for absenteeism, low Black father involvement, or even in some instances where there were higher levels of Black father involvement, that was also included in the dissertation. Because, you know, not to make the dissertation, it not to be a piece of subjective work, but try to get a full picture, you know, just like, what does this look like really in a nutshell? What is the Black father's experience? What has it been like, you know, thus far? So that's pretty much what it was in a nutshell. I know I could talk about it just for hours because I spent so much time, you know, with it, but that's pretty much what it discussed. So like, again, those areas that you just mentioned from the from the census, 2020 census website that you can just read now.
Right. Right. And that wasn't, I don't think that was that available when you were writing your lit review chapter two?
No.
I didn't think so.
Did the lit review, I believe it was 2019. So right. Yes, it wasn't available.
So yeah, we worked together for a while, and on this dissertation, you did finish, by the way, everybody. A round of applause for Dr. Donald. But and I am extremely proud and impressed by anybody accomplishing the PhD, but especially the way you did it was very commendable. You interviewed 18 Black fathers, and sort of the way that you approached it, maybe, you know, was sort of like, what was your experience with your own father, and then how are you parenting now, if at all? And so what were some of the sort of most interesting findings that you had?
So for the participants, I think that for me, there were two things that I thought that were of great interest. One was their description or descriptions of their experiences with their fathers. And there was a mixed bag of answers. There were some who noted that their dad was present. There were some that noted that their dad was like more in a co-parenting type of relationship with their mothers. And then there were others who never really knew nothing about their fathers.
Right. And
I think the most interesting part was that out of all 18 of those participants, despite their relationships with their fathers, they all responded to being excited about fatherhood and also being present, and that they were happy to be present in the lives of their children, that they were physically present, that they were engaged with their children, and that that was like the most important part of their being was, you know, being in their child or in their children's lives. So I think that for me, that just spoke volumes, just given the fact that, again, looking at, you know, everyone's different backgrounds, different age groups, different experiences. But that was the one commonality, was that they were all excited about fatherhood.
Right. Yeah, we talked about that. That was really interesting to me when I started reading your findings and your results, and you started putting that together and making me review it, you know, and I enjoyed it sometimes. But, you know, the process is hard, but the information is always interesting. And that was just fascinating that all 18 of your participants we're saying, no, I want to be the best father I can. And we talked about some of the reasons why there was such a high percentage, all 18. I mean, I don't think you could, you know, I think that's very hard to find 18 different fathers that are so motivated to do the best they can to be a great father. But we talked about, I think you recruited through your networks, which, right, to some degree, where a lot of the fathers that got the recruitment, that were recruited, were more likely to already be sort of on board with, like, well, I'm already interested in what, you know, maybe they knew you from the work you do with fathers. And so they were already a little bit primed. They were already interested and invested in being fathers. Is that accurate?
Kind of, sort of, but yeah, I would be remiss to not mention the fact that they also were a part of a nonprofit, but not a nonprofit that I'm affiliated with or, you know,
okay,
work with. But still, I think that within this nonprofit that they were affiliated with, even though they didn't have, this nonprofit doesn't offer any programs specific for men, but it's more of their approach is more about the family as a whole. Mm-hmm. So I still would say that with them being affiliated with the programs that nonprofit offers, probably, if it didn't prime them, it may have also motivated them mm-hmm. in a sense that, wow, at least being a part of this research project, because it's like, okay, now this is something that is focusing more on like, what is the father experience? What does that look like? So yeah, I think it's a combination of both. I think that I would have to agree with them being affiliated with the nonprofit that focuses on healthy families, and also just being able to have the opportunity to have a discussion about that fatherhood piece was probably something that that was of interest to our 18 participants.
Yeah, so, and I remember when we started this conversation about, and everybody, if you're watching because you're planning to do a dissertation or you're working on it, we all have this conversation at the beginning. What are you going to study? What's a research problem? All that, making sure it's justified, all that discussion. But with you, we came to this sort of early discussion, I recall. I think it's important. We talked about, we were sort of talking about what we call BFA, Black Father Absenteeism. And then we discussed, that's sort of negative. That's negative, and it doesn't account for the fathers that are present. And there are fathers that are present, like your own father, right? And plenty of fathers throughout. I just don't know. I don't ask everybody if their father was present. But you got that opportunity to do so. But we sort of decided to operationalize it wasn't a variable so much, but it was sort of to understand it as a continuum of involvement instead of just a dichotomous. Were you present or were you gone? And what did you hear about that from these regarding their own fathers? What did they say? Were they across the spectrum of involvement?
They were. In terms of physically being present, and I'm just doing this off the top of my head, of the 18 participants, I believe physically present, there were like three dads that said their dads were physically present. I believe that there were two dads that had unique situations where they had a stepfather and they also had their biological father. One of the dads had the stepfather that was present. Bio dad really wasn't present a whole lot. The other dad, neither the step or the biological father was physically present. Mm-hmm. And then the remainder of them, they mentioned that either that dad wasn't present at all, or they just didn't even know anything about their fathers. So yeah, it was pretty evident that out of the 18 participants that, unfortunately, the majority of them grew up in a home where dad wasn't physically present.
And yet all of them were sort of committed to some degree. We're not going out and following them and watching their lives, but they were at least stating, this is important to me that I either, if their father was involved in their life and present, they said, I want to be like that. And the ones that experienced a more absent father, more on that end of the spectrum, they were saying, I want to do better. I want my kids to have me involved. Is that fair?
That's very accurate. No, that was what I that was my takeaway from those interviews, was that these 18 men, they made a conscious decision that, like you said, either they were going to emulate their fathers or they were going to be nothing like their dads. And I think it's safe to say that for the ones that chose not to be anything like their fathers, they're proud to say that, you know. So it's not like, you know, they say that with shame or they say that with any sort of level of regret. It's just that, hey, they're thankful for the fact that they experienced what they experienced from their fathers, because they felt that it only motivated them more to do more and to try to be better for their children. So,
right. I mean, they would be the people that would know among other people, but if you didn't have a father, well, they were able to tell you, I wish I had. Or they could have, in contrast, told you, yeah, I was good. It was good without him. And maybe they survived. Obviously, they were resilient. They did okay. They were, you know, good enough to have children of their own. Many of them, I think, or all of them, and to be on a good path. But it was just interesting to see how they responded to all that. And another thing that was interesting, I think, that you noted was the stepfathers. That was sort of interesting, wasn't it? And I think it just pointed out that, you know, sometimes people step in and fill that role to some degree. But also, I don't know if you saw any evidence of this. I keep thinking, you know, even some fathers that are, quote, present, living in the home or whatever, they're not so present. They may not be involved. Did you have anybody that shared a story like that?
One of the participants mentioned that, yes, while the father was present, he felt like he felt as though that relationship could have been a much better relationship. But he also mentioned that when he was younger, that those were his thoughts. But as since he's become a father, and you know, I guess now kind of in retrospect, it could have been better, but it wasn't as bad as he had thought it, you know, was like as a child and, you know, coming up through his adolescent years. So, but still, just the fact that he mentioned that. So, I mean, that there was still, I guess, in his mind, room where that relationship could have, you know, it could have been better between him and his father.
And you heard about you did the research, you reviewed, you evaluated the transcripts of each interview, coded it, analyzed it. What were the obstacles to fathers being attached to their children in your study?
For some, it was, again, we're talking about participants, and we're talking about the relationships between them and their fathers. So the obstacles that were present, prison, alcoholism. I think one of the dads responded that his dad was somewhat of, I guess, like a womanizer. So just pretty much just kind of like out, really for reasons that he really didn't know, but he just knew that that's just kind of what it was. As he put it, he said his dad was a street, you know, person. So, and also I think that even though it may have not been said explicitly, I kind of got the feeling that for the ones who may have had a little bit of information, that the number one barrier for some of their dads was also like that relationship between their dad and their grandfathers. You know, like two participants kind of alluded to that, where based off of what knowledge that they had, they don't think that their fathers and grandfathers had the best relationships in terms of the grandfather being attached to their father. Now, I don't know what that meant. I don't know if it meant that, again, the grandfather was physically present, but just not engaged with their dad, or if the grandfather wasn't present and not engaged. So I don't know, because now the research didn't go
right.
Question about the grandfathers, but it did come up. So, and of course, I mean, that could create a barrier if, unfortunately, if dad experienced this with granddad and he made the decision, going back to what we just mentioned earlier, to not be a part of his child's life. So, it's kind of, unfortunately, it's a cycle, or it could be a cycle.
I like that word, cycle, or sort of, I think cycle's probably best, but yeah, it's sort of like almost like a tradition and expectations and responsibilities of like, well, I just maybe some people, you know, it's sort of like you're taught to behave a certain way. Maybe some fathers really don't, they're not taught to do it, maybe, and thus they don't, maybe they don't develop the skill set, which is there, I know there are skills, but a lot of it's just being there, right? And loving your kid. I want to get to the sort of practical. What can be done? What can be done in the world? Is there anything? And I know your study was a qualitative study, 18 people sharing their stories. And there's more research that needs to be done. But what can we take from what you learned and sort of say, well, these are some possible solutions, or at least beginnings of solutions?
Absolutely. So, I mean, you already mentioned the first, I think one of the things that's going to be important moving forward is that additional research should be done. I think it needs to be done. But also, like you said, in a practical sense, you know, and I mentioned this also in the dissertation, you know, kind of like in the recommendations, a portion of the dissertation, I think that being able to develop programs, whatever that may look like, I don't necessarily know what that should look like, but just being able to develop programs that focus more on fatherhood. And also, I think being able to create curriculums that can better equip men on fatherhood, because oftentimes I think that people feel that if you seek help or if you seek advice, that you're automatically saying that you're doing a bad job. And that may not necessarily be the case. But I think that if we have programs available where other men can see that, oh, wow, you know, I'm not in this alone. I'm not the only one that feel this way. And that, okay, this is not necessarily a bad thing, that, you know, I care enough about my child or my children that I just want to, I guess the analogy I can think of is, you know, just having like a tool bag and saying, okay, I can add additional tools to this tool bag. It's not to say that the tools that I already possess are the wrong tools, but we already know that there's a time to use certain tools. You know, if you think about taking a hammer and a nail, you drive a hammer and a nail, you know, okay, if you're trying, that will definitely fasten something, you know, to a wall or whatever the case may be. But then there's also times where it's more effective to use, you know, a screw and then use a screwdriver. But I mean, you could definitely take a hammer and still drive a screw into the wall, but it's going to probably be more effective if you use a screwdriver. So I think that's kind of like where my hope would be, that we could take information from this dissertation and we could use it to help fathers. So that way they would know not to blame them, but to get them to realize that maybe some of the tools that we've been using just aren't as effective. Not to say that they haven't worked to some degree, but there are other things that we can do that might be a little bit more effective And I think also too, I think in a sense to celebrate fatherhood too, because really, if you think about it, fathers just really aren't celebrated a whole lot either. So, so I think just making fatherhood something that it isn't to be feared. And I'm just saying that because I think about people that I know personally, like they hear that word and it just, it freaks them out. It's like, wow, I'm going to be a father and I cannot believe this. And it's like, it's really not that bad of an experience. Actually, it's a great experience, but I think being able to change mindsets around what fatherhood really consists of and what it looks like is what I hope that this dissertation could at least start to do.
Yeah, I think it gave you a lot of information about here's what these fathers are feeling and thinking, and it sort of that generational impact of like whatever my father did with me, regardless, these 18 fathers wanted to be very involved with their children, wanted to be good fathers. So I think overall, it just sort of emphasized the importance of being a father. And you know, you can get into a lot of the details in future research, but, you know, just to say, first of all, you know, to these fathers maybe in programs, first of all, it's important that you're there. And these are, you know, just like I read those statistics of, you know, single parent families when the father's not present. Well, we can flip that on its head and say, here's the good that you can do. You're going to be, you know, just flip all those statistics and say, if you are involved, we can, you know, decrease all these risks. You know, and not all fathers are created equal, and some are really amazing. And I'd say every father makes mistakes along the way. Every parent makes mistakes along the way. Mine did. I will, I'm sure you have, but it's a learning process and just showing that that effort. And I think these gentlemen that you work with are, you know, that just by showing up, they're showing that effort of like, I want to learn, you know, that's pretty cool to me. Your whole dissertation was pretty cool to me. And we talked about, you know, systemic racism and somehow law enforcement. There was some unease, some bad experiences with law enforcement. And so there were sort of some tangents to the primary study where saying, you know, some of the fathers didn't feel comfortable with the police and so looking into that implications and how much that affects just feelings of just comfort, you know, in the home and as you're raising your child, and whether if you're a Black father, you know, you have to have that conversation. If you ever get stopped, here's what to do. You got to be a lot more careful in some situations. So we got into that, but I think most of all, you just underscored the importance of fatherhood. You have any response to that?
That was one area. That was another area I neglected to mention earlier that the response out of the 18 dads were that 16 of the 18 did not feel comfortable with the law enforcement. And one of the participants happened to be a former detective, so he was a part of law enforcement. The other dad was, he's in the military. So they were more or less disappointed. It wasn't necessarily like uncomfortable, but they were disappointed with some of the current law enforcement policies and I guess like the lack of training and things of that nature. So more logistical issues, I think, were like more or less their concerns. But yeah, I mean, overall, it was impactful to see that, because again, it you know, when we think about the physical implications, we know that if you're locked up or if you're harmed in some sort of way, that if you're physically not present, that will affect your level of attachment and involvement. So, and then like I said, that concern for their own children, because some of these men were of age where they're now grandparents. So just thinking about their children and thinking about what that would look like. So it was pretty sobering.
Yeah, and you were collecting data, I believe, just after the George Floyd shooting, correct? Or somewhere right around that time. And so it was even more sort of emphasized, I believe, just because there have been so many recent, sort of negative interactions with law enforcement that have been in the public eye. So what's next for you, Eric? You're done, you're a doctor, Dr. Eric, Dr. Donald. I don't know which we'll go with. You get to decide. But yeah, what are you doing next? I know we talked about sort of figuring some of it out, but.
So what's next for me is some of the things that we mentioned in terms of practical applications. So I would like to be involved in writing curriculums, some of those curriculums that we just discussed, doing workshops. I know you and I have talked, hopefully being able to have an opportunity to collaborate with you. I know that Dr. Tanksell also, during my defense, extended a warm welcome to, reach out to her at any time. So I guess I want to continue research. I don't know what that will look like, but I do know that I want to continue in some sort of way to affect what fatherhood looks like now. So I'm pretty excited. Sorry I don't have a real clear answer, but I think that I'm excited, and I'm just excited for the different types of possibilities. But I do know that I wanted to focus on fatherhood.
Yeah, and you did. And I think you did a great job. And you do, we talked, and you have some great ideas, and 2 months is, it's only been a couple months. Exactly, I think, right? So, you've got some time to figure it out. How do you feel? Do you feel like, man, I'm so glad I did this, or man, I spent a lot of money? What's your thought looking back at it and saying, I spent this amount of time and this amount of money, and how does it feel to be finished and look back at it?
Oddly enough, I believe it's been a mix. I've had mixed emotions because I think I was so focused on finally finishing up. And once that happened, I was happy. I was grateful to be finished. But then after about 2 weeks of being finished, I really didn't think about what would this look like. I would compare this to how do parents feel once they become empty nesters? It's like they go throughout their entire lives with their children being in the home, and they're just I cannot wait for the last one to leave out the door. But then once that last child leaves out the door, it's kind of wow, we didn't think ahead, what would this look like? Starting today, this is, you no longer have to get up and do this, or you have to be focused on that. And I think for me, that's kind of when everything kind of, I guess it began to sink in a little bit, because I was there's nothing that's dissertation related that I need to work ahead on, or, send Dr. Gooden an email to see what's the next steps in the process, or, you know, revisions. It was just like, it's done, it's over with. So as strange as it seems, I actually missed, like, the first, like I said, maybe the first couple of weeks, I missed the process, because this was a journey that I started back in 2015. So that was 6 years. And, you know, to have something that's a part of your life for 6 years, and then all of a sudden, you know, it comes to an end. Like I said, I just had mixed emotions. I was happy and grateful, but I also, I was a little sad to see it, you know, all kind of come to an end. So,
well, you know, I'm still here, and we have some things that we're thinking about doing together. There's plenty of goals left, but for anybody watching that's still a student or planning, thinking about being a student, you know, there is this time, like, after you finish, when it's just surreal. It's, you have all this existential sort of thoughts of, like, that have to do with your identity. Who am I now? I'm not a doctoral student anymore. I'm a doctor. And my purpose in life, you know, my daily goal is finished. You know, like, I reached that. So what do I do now? You know, and I'm like, well, relax, celebrate, you know, and you can only do that so much before you're like, but I feel lazy, you know, and so that, I would say that, you know, that's a good opportunity for people when you finish, you know, celebrate, relax, sure, but then pick up, you know, figure out what to do next. And I think you're on the right track with that. So don't get too anxious about it. It will sort itself out as long as you're putting in the work. It's not going to sort itself out if you just lay on the couch eating Cheetos. You and your Cheetos, I made that up. I don't know if you eat Cheetos. They are bad for your fingers getting all nasty. So, Eric, it was a pleasure working with you. I want to ask you, and I warned you about this. What do you have to share that you might tell some people? What are a few things, thoughts come to mind from the desk of Dr. Donald?
Absolutely. So I think the one piece of information I would like to share with everyone is that, as early on as you possibly can in your dissertation journey, do everything that you can to try to recondition your mindset. And the reason why I say that is because most of us, if not all of us, if you go all the way back to grade school and go all the way through even your master's program, we've been essentially conditioned to, like, have a teacher, an instructor, a professor give us an assignment and grade us on our performance. And that's pretty much it. And maybe you may have a test to try to see how proficient, you know, you are in that subject, and it's on to the next course or on to the next class. But the dissertation process is, like, totally different than that, because A, you're the creator of, like, what this topic is going to be about. And B, once you create the topic, and I'll just share this with everyone to just give a little bit of insight of what type of student I was. My entire life, I was fortunate. I didn't have real difficult times, even in subjects that I really didn't have interest in. I could always get through them and, you know, just kind of just essentially breeze through. And it was even the same way undergrad and even in my master's program, and even with the coursework for the dissertation, it was like, okay, this is familiar. This whole, you know, the setup is familiar to me. But once, after I left the prospectus and went into the actual dissertation program, writing of the dissertation, one of the things that I did that was not of a benefit to me was that I had conditioned myself not to read feedback and comments from my instructors. And I vividly remember having a conversation with you, Dr. Gooden. We had a talk like we're talking right now.
Yeah.
Gave some feedback. I submitted the work. And obviously, I resubmitted what I already had submitted. And I appreciate you for this, but you reached out to me. And you were like, hey, is everything okay? Because you just had a talk. And I know, like, based off of what we talked about, it seemed like, you know, we were on the same page. But then it's like the work you submitted, like, what happened? So it was in that instance that I went back and I read the feedback. And it was just like, wow. Had I done this initially, I would have saw exactly why, you know, you reached out to me to question if I was okay or not, because, I mean, it was clear, it was explicit, like, hey, you know, if you take care of A, then, you know, take care of the rest of this. And then for me to resubmit what I had already submitted originally, that was like a teachable moment for me. And I think that the reason why that was important, because from that moment, once I started to value the feedback and actually started reading the feedback, it just made the journey a lot easier. I mean, I'm not saying that there weren't periods where I still had, you know, I found it difficult to move forward, but I still had a better sense of like where I stood even within the journey. But if there's anyone out there that was, you know, like myself, that just really don't care to read feedback, then get ready for like a real long like journey, because you really don't have a sense of where you are in the process if you're not taking the feedback that your chair is providing to you seriously. And also my advice would be try to do the best you can to build up a rapport with your chair, because once you're able to communicate more with your chair, they want you to succeed. So they're going to work with you and help you through the process. So that would just be my number one advice, because like I said, I just came in like, hey, this is going to be the equivalency of writing a master's level thesis. This is on a larger scale. That's all. No sweat. And lo and behold, I found out that it was totally different. Some similarity, but enough differences to really create a problem, a lot of self-imposed problems. So, yep, my advice would be just to stay focused and stay on top of communications between you and your chair and committee, and build a relationship between your chair and the committee as quick as you possibly can. So,
yeah, I appreciate you pointing that out. It's just, it's something you can't do it alone. That's why you have a chair. That's why the chair, everybody, I don't know, mentions their chair. You know, that becomes a person in your life. Even if you hate them, love them, whatever, they're the person that is your, I always, you know, say coach, guide, Sherpa, whatever you want to call them. They're the person that tells you when to take a left, when to take a right, when to keep going straight, when to speed up, slow down, and all in terms of like writing a paper. You know, that's my job, and I've had to learn to do it and hopefully keep getting better at it. But if the student ignores that, you know, it's just like, no, I'm just going to keep going the speed I'm going. I'm like, that's not going to work out for you. And that's what you're saying is, you know, because it's such a unique project and process that you have to have that guide, or you're going to get lost. Whereas so many other things are just like, all right, you work on this, you turn it in, I'll give you a grade. And that's not what we do with the dissertation. We work on it till it's right, so to speak, until it reaches some threshold of scholarship and excellence. And that's what you did. You finished, it's almost, I normally use the metaphor of like a marathon. You're running this marathon, and it is like that, but you're also, it's sort of like a rising tide or something, to where you're rising and you're gaining competence along the way. And finally, eventually you reach a threshold of competence and excellence in scholarship to where you, Eric, are now worthy of being called doctor, and you've earned your PhD, and that final defense of your dissertation was just, as I told you before you did it, it's a symbolic event, you know, to where I already know that you know you did all this work, you know it. This is just your final presentation. It's like you're going to do it, you know, some dance at the end of everything, and we're going to watch and celebrate. And man, you did it. You did a fantastic job. I look forward to hopefully having you back on and maybe doing some work about working with fathers, Black fathers, but maybe fathers of all colors, and just see how we can help. I say, if we help the fathers, we help the children, right? And so we're helping our future generations, and maybe having a big impact on society, you know. And it's not just about males, you know. If we teach our males to have integrity, character, morals, principles, values, to be good people, to do the next right thing, then how are they going to interact with women? You know, they're going to interact with respect, hopefully, with boundaries. They're gonna be partnered with them, and work alongside them, and hopefully be just keep getting better as men. So I love what you do. I've loved the topic since you introduced it to me, and I think there's a lot more work to be done. You have any final thoughts or statements you want to, or any plugs for yourself? If anybody wanted to reach out to you, how would they do that? Anything like that?
If anyone wanted to reach out to me right now, I'm still in the process of trying to get my consulting page up, but I can be reached at my email address, which is Jed, I can spell it out, jedd1977@gmail.com. And just put in the topic line, like, what is it in regards to? Just put fatherhood, and I would know that this is something that that's related to, like, the work that I'm doing around fatherhood. But I do want to appreciate you, Dr. Goon, for, you know, giving me an opportunity to come discuss my dissertation and just have an opportunity just to talk to you, because, like I said, we've always had great conversations in the past, and I look forward to continuing this conversation.
I don't know the word, but, you know, because it gets all weird with who's the father, who's the son, and who's the brother, are we brothers or whatever, but without figuring all that out, I'd say, you know, with a lot of students, it feels like family at the end of it, no matter what you want to call it, but you feel like family to me. We've had some long conversations over time, and really dug through some difficult things as the George Floyd stuff was going on. We talked about it, you and I, and we just were respectful and kind to each other. And anyway, I've appreciated this. Everybody, reach out to Eric Donald. You also have a LinkedIn page. I don't know if you follow it, but you know, if you pay attention to it. But everybody, please, you know, send out a shout out to Eric Donald. This has been Driven to Doctorate, hosted by me, Dr. Joel B. Gooden, and guest Eric Donald. Dr. Eric Donald. All right. Thank you.
Hello, audio listeners. This is Joel. I'm Dr. Gooden, but you can call me Joel. Listen, I'm trying to put good content out there, and it takes time to do it. And I'm not real good at putting everything together yet. I'm getting better. I'm trying to come up with new ideas. I want to listen to you and hear what you want. In order to make all this happen, I would love to have a little bit of investment. If you like what you're hearing, it would help me to spend more time to do this. If you could give any donation to my Stripe account, just supporting the podcast. Thank you so much for considering this. Even a dollar would help. If you've got a dollar that you can spare just to say, hey, you're headed in the right direction, I got something out of this, that would be great. Don't forget to like, subscribe, share, comment, give 7 thumbs up, stars, whatever they are. But overall, thank you for listening, and thank you for any support you can provide. Even a dollar would help. Thank you. Has been Driven to Doctorate with Dr. Joel B. Gooden, an Easy Tiger Entertainment and B. Gooden Productions series. Thank you for listening. Please like, subscribe, share, and stay tuned for more Gooden content.